I will call this meeting of the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. It is Thursday, February 24th. This meeting is being held remotely per Rule 10.01. We'll get started first with the roll. Anna, go ahead.
Chair Becca Finn.
Present.
Vice Chair Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier. Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Johnson is present.
Johnson is present. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny. Representative Farr.
Farr present.
Representative Robbins. Representative Fang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
Present.
Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Frazier is also present.
Frazier is also present, for the record. A quorum is present. First on the agenda today is approval of the minutes. Representative Feist, do I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 22nd, 2022?
Yes, Madam Chair, so moved.
All right. Any discussion to the minutes of February 22nd? All right, seeing no hands, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the minutes of February 22nd, 2022, that was a lot of twos, are now approved. We've got another full agenda today. First up is House File 2910. Vice Chair Moeller, would you like to move your bill?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, Vice Chair Moeller moves House File 2910 be referred to the General Register. I understand that you have an A2 amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and then tell us what it does?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair. So this amendment is just a small fix, but an important one. I'll explain it when I go through the text of the, or when I go through the bill, but it puts the bill in the shape I desire.
All right, any questions to the A2 amendment? All right, seeing no hands, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, the A2 amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Moeller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So members, as you know, there has been an increase in carjackings in Minnesota like there has been across the country, often accompanied with violence or threats of violence. But along with that, we're also hearing about attempts by law enforcement to stop a person driving a stolen car only to be met with a dangerous high-speed chase. These chases lead to a risk to public safety, risking the lives of innocent drivers on the road, the officers trying to stop the cars, and anyone inside the stolen car. From the Pioneer Press earlier this month, they talked about a case in December when a Robbinsdale officer tried to pull over a vehicle that had been reported stolen in a carjacking. Police say the driver fled and crashed. There were five juveniles in the car, two of whom died and others were injured. In September, two passengers in a stolen vehicle, only ages 14 and 15, died when their friend crashed after a Ramsey County Sheriff's deputy tried to pull him over in Maplewood. The article continues, quote, even before those instances, many law enforcement agencies had tightened their pursuit policies, citing safety reasons, close quote. If these high-speed chases are called off due to safety reasons, the suspect is not apprehended and evidence needed for later prosecution is lost. When I spoke to my local law enforcement about this issue, the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office told me about their desire to use available GPS technology to address this problem, and they're here today to explain that technology. The use of such technology can enable law enforcement to keep eyes on the stolen vehicle that is fleeing until they can safely apprehend that suspect while also keeping the public safe from dangerous high-speed pursuits. This bill is necessary because even though the Fourth Amendment allows the technology to be used in exigent circumstances, our current law makes it a gross misdemeanor for law enforcement to use GPS technology on a stolen car that is fleeing unless they have the owner's consent, and that consent is often not practical in these circumstances. That said, I understand concerns about the use of these devices indefinitely and once exigent circumstances have passed. I want to thank the ACLU for their suggestion regarding time limits. And after that conversation, we added the provision that only allows for the technology to be used on a reported stolen car for up to 24 hours unless law enforcement secures a search warrant for continued use. And I note that the change to search warrant in the amendment we adopted today is based on feedback from Mr. Neumeister, who will still testify in opposition to the bill, but whose input I appreciate. Finally, I also want to ensure that once a stolen car has been recovered and returned to its owner, innocent owners won't be mistaken for car thieves. Thus, paragraphs C and D ensure that officers must remove the devices upon recovery and that no evidence collected after that return of the car is admissible. This bill has the support of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Chiefs of Police Association, the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and there's a handout in support of the bill by the National Insurance Crime Bureau. Senator Johnson's carrying the companion bill. And with that, Madam Chair, my testifier is Under Sheriff Martin.
All right, we'll go to testifiers. Under Sheriff Martin, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you for having me today. I'm Under Sheriff Mike Martin. I'm the commander of the Regional Services Division for the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. So I oversee many units within the sheriff's office, but especially our auto theft and carjacking teams that work to address these crimes. I've been a police officer for more than 30 years, licensed in the state of Minnesota. And I can tell you, up until recently, it was very rare to see carjackings. And generally, they were drug-induced robbery sprees where someone takes a car and it was rare to have more than 10 or 12 a year in the metro area. Now, this past year, there were 101 carjackings in the city of St. Paul alone, and there were 617 in the city of Minneapolis. In Ramsey County, we probably had another 30 carjackings outside of the city of St. Paul. These crimes are extremely traumatic to the victims. There's also a tremendous financial cost. Our carjacking and auto theft team in the last 6 months has recovered more than $2 million worth of vehicles. But there's also a tremendous cost to in the form of insurance premiums, which disproportionately affects those who live in the areas that are experiencing the most carjackings. And many of our victims can't afford even the deductibles for the insurance. It creates a lot of issues. We are doing everything we can within law enforcement to reduce the number of high-speed chases that we are engaged in. But these carjackers are violent individuals, a lot of them young individuals, and we need to apprehend them. We need to recover these vehicles. Up until recently, our only options were to either discontinue a chase because of safety reasons. Some agencies don't even chase, or to use the state patrol helicopter, which a lot of times it takes 20, 30 minutes to get up in the air and get to the area where we need them. And the cost of that is very prohibitive. There are reasonably affordable devices now that we can deploy on stolen vehicles that will allow us to back off, not have to pursue the vehicle, and then just kind of follow it to the areas where it's going, wait for it to stop, or park in a place where we can box it in, and then safely recover the vehicle and apprehend the suspects. There are some that are deployable by hand, which are small GPS devices. If we can get close enough, we can throw them onto the car from an unmarked car or squad car. And that before we even initiate trying to stop that vehicle. That way, if it flees, we don't have to risk the chase. There are also now devices that will shoot a spongy object. It's hard to explain, that sticks to the vehicle. So if we can get close enough, shoot that at the vehicle, then we can back off, and it allows for us to do that. Many agencies in the state have explored those. Some have already purchased those devices, but we need this change in the state law to allow us to do this. And as Representative Mueller said, we only want this until we find the vehicle or the time expires. After that amount of time, we would be able to either get a warrant or get consent of the owners to be able to track that vehicle. So thank you for allowing my testimony.
Thank you, Under Sheriff Martin. The next testifier we have is Julia Decker. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Julia Decker, Policy Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. We're providing brief testimony on HF 2910, and we'd like to thank Representative Mueller for reaching out to us on this bill in advance. The ACLU of Minnesota had concerns with the initial bill as introduced because it presented a risk of extended warrantless surveillance. At the same time, we understood the stated rationale was to avoid high-speed chases that could arise out of exigent circumstances. We appreciate the addition of the time limit to the warrantless tracking that this bill otherwise could have permitted. As many of you know, and as we've expressed to Representative Mueller in advance, the ACLU of Minnesota continues to be broadly concerned about the rapid development and deployment of technology that can increase secret warrantless surveillance. This deployment often outstrips existing laws, which can have impacts and implications for the civil liberties of all Minnesotans. So we would just urge this committee and the legislature to continue to assess bills for these types of impacts and implications, and to remember that just because technology can infringe on civil liberties in ways that previous cases did not envision, does not mean that it should. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have one more testifier on the list. Rich Neumeister, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Chair Becker-Finn, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'll be expressing 4 points about the bill. If you look at the engrossment language on pages 110, 111, 112, you will see the beginning on 110, or. That to me is an exception and is far different than what Undersheriff Martin and Representative Mueller is saying. In exigent circumstances, they wish to deploy either by throwing or by a dart injected push like a little rocket, it goes under the car. With that language, law enforcement will be able to place on a not fleeing car, not in a hot pursuit, but it's just say you're going down the street and you see, you do a records check. Oh, that car is stolen. Let's put a beeper on it. Or if it's on private property and you see it's stolen. See, there is no prohibition about the ability to be able to put on a beeper in a non-exigent circumstance. That's a concern. To me, that is a big loophole. And with the ease and the low cost of these devices, I can see where in a non-exigent circumstance, a beeper could be placed and then followed for 24 hours. And maybe the car may not be stolen, or maybe it was a wrong check. The data is wrong in the computer base. To fix that, I would suggest take that language out and just put or exigent circumstances. So then the fine that Representative Mueller talks about won't happen. to me, there's just some mischief and abuse that could happen to that. Number two, you will note that 626, 835 through 39 deals with mobile tracking devices. This language was created in 1988 and 89. I was a part of that, of helping with this law. And so I followed it closely over the decades, and there has not been any major update to relate to court cases on both a federal and state level. Now, some people who were on the other committee, which I did submit here, gave a Court of Appeals case from 2016 called the libel case. It basically said two things. One, you need a search warrant, and you need probable cause to put a beeper on a vehicle. If you look at our state statute, it doesn't say that. And so while we're taking this opportunity to add more things, I think it's incumbent upon the legislature to update the law, to let the public know, the citizens know what cops can actually do, and then put in statute without having to refer to some case law from years ago, two of them basically, that the cops, you can only use a search warrant. Number three, one of the things that with the addition of the search warrant, and thank you, Representative Mueller, Madam Chair, Representative Mueller for doing that, is that if you leave it as is, the public will never know and how these mobile tracking devices are being used. That is part of the old law that was done 30 years ago before court cases have been developed. So as this bill goes forward, I would like to suggest some kind of language either based on regular 626 search warrant language or in 626A that eventually the search warrant will become public. Because if you go under the scheme of 626 A30, A35 through 39, it might be interpreted by some people that it never becomes public, which has been the case for the last 30 years. On the fourth point, I would like to suggest that some type of reporting be done about this. You know, if law enforcement are going to be using mobile tracking devices as they so state, it's real easy just, you know, to have to, you know, just do a real quick report to the legislature, not forever, but just to see how this works. How is it deployed? And I think some general language can be developed on that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, it's a pleasure to speak with you all. And I can stand for any questions if there are any.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Before moving on to discussion, any response by Chair Mueller before we move on?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just say with respect to updating 626A, I think that is a good idea. And I don't think we should hold up the bill to do that now. But I did talk to Representative Scott about that. And that's something that I would be happy to work on with her. That's all for now. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. First on the list, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Mueller, for the discussions on this and for those that are online that have testified. And I'll start with saying, I think Mr. Neumeister makes a couple of good points. We already have precedent and statute for making the warrants public after a period of time, and then furnishing the public with a report of how often these warrants have been used. I do have a question for Under Sheriff, is it Martin or is it Mick Martin? Martin, okay. If I might, Madam Chair. Under Sheriff, I'm just wondering, you mentioned that some law enforcement agencies have already purchased these. Do you know if they've already been deployed in some areas?
Under Sheriff Martin.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, yes, they have been, but only with the owner's consent. And that's one of the big issues that we have is oftentimes we can't in a timely fashion reach the registered owners to get that consent. So if we see a stolen car, a carjacked car, and we don't have the ability to get a hold of that registered owner, if it's someone who we have had consent from that we've already talked to and said, hey, do you mind if we do this? then we have done it. We have deployed it on vehicles, but only after receiving the consent from the owner.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you for that. I'm glad to at least hear that they're waiting for consent before they use them. I encourage members, if they haven't, these devices are kind of crazy. One is called Star Chase, and I encourage people to look them up and see the brief demonstration of these things. It's if you self-deploy, if a law enforcement officer actually throws it at them, they better have some pretty good aim, but they do have a little launcher too. If I could ask the undersheriff another question, Madam Chair. Thank you. What's the unit price of one of these? Because I kind of dug into the website of Star Chase, and there was never any pricing. You had to contact them for pricing. What do they cost?
It's never a good sign when they don't put the price online.
I know.
Under Sheriff Martin.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, it varies depending, but Star Chase, I believe, is around $15,000 to have installed on a squad. And it allows you to deploy two devices. The individual, that's the actual method of deploying it, is mounted on a squad. But then individually, it's relatively negligible, the cost of the devices that are actually shot towards the vehicle. There are handheld devices that are as cheap as $20. We had one case where one of our unmarked cars saw a carjacked vehicle. Actually, he was in an unmarked car. He was able to pull up next to it, put the a little GPS puck on the trunk of the vehicle, reach out his window, put it on. And then when that vehicle fled, we were able to track the vehicle. So it just kind of depends on the technology.
Follow-up, Representative Scott. It's very like Spider-Man, Batman looking, but it looks like the one, I know I looked it up, it looks kind of like a fat Nerf dart, the launcher that's on the vehicle. Representative Scott.
Thank you. It's quite something. I can think the eyes kind of popped out of my head when I first saw it. I just want to put on the record here, I understand the need for this, and it's sad that we have a need for this with the amount of carjackings that are going on now. And my concern is, even if we catch these people with the revolving door that we have right now, where they're being let back out, that is a huge concern. So even if we use this device and allow it, which I understand the need for, my concern is the revolving door that we have right now, and we have to fix that. So that's all, Madam Chair. Thank you for letting me ask my question.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, the question before us today is whether this is a kind of technology we want to let law enforcement have better access to. And I know that Vice Chair Mueller's been doing her homework, as she always does, and talking to folks. She put this together. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. In response to Mr. Neumeister's questions about when the proper use of the device would be, when I was doing use of force training, I used to have a saying that the proper use of a lower use of force in most situations will eliminate the need for a higher use of force later. If we wait until the vehicle is fleeing, in most situations that opportunity is lost. So I understand the point that he's trying to make, but the best time to do it is best time to use a force. Or in this place, apply the device is before it's fleeing. We want to eliminate that situation. In many of these situations, the vehicle, once you turn those lights on, if the driver decides that they're going to flee, they're going to flee. And you want to end that as fast as we can. If they only need to go a couple blocks before you can have a very disastrous crash, even if the units have discontinued, they'll still keep going for a little while. So that is all I have to say, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Otney. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Mueller, thank you for bringing this bill forward. This technology is very valuable for law enforcement. Our number of carjackings, which are actually armed robberies, is skyrocketed. It's out of control. And the worst part is 90% of those are unsolved. I can't remember what do you have, close to 500 last year and just in the metro area. It's real dangerous for the public. These people need to be caught. This technology is a way to catch those that are doing these serious violent crimes. But the tough part is that's a little frustrating for the law enforcement world. We want to do it, and we want to do it correctly. The interesting part is we're restricting law enforcement's uses of these devices. Special situations only can use it for a very limited amount of time. Now, we heard that these hockey pucks type deals, these devices you put on the vehicle, are cost less than $20. They're available to the public. The public can use these anytime they want. There's no restrictions on the public. They could have that on there for years, getting data where you're going to. Now, we're restricting law enforcement, who's out there. Their duty is to protect our civil liberties and our rights and to protect us. But we're restricting their ability, while those who want to use it improperly, we're not doing anything about. I suggest we get this bill through, but we also need to look at restricting how people use these in the public world, because they can be very much badly abused. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Next on the list, I have Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Representative Mueller for bringing this bill. I am in strong support. Just to piggyback on what Representative Johnson was just talking about, however, there is a serious issue of people using tracking devices, both the sort of the tags, but also apps on phones for tracking people without their consent or knowledge. And I have a bill that is not back from the reviser, but it's coming on Monday. And I hope we can also hear that this session. I know we're coming up against deadline, but I have reams of articles and examples. And I think this is something I hope we will all consider. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. I certainly prosecuted enough stalking cases where that certainly was a tool that was used, especially the apps on phones. So we'll see. I can't give you any promises when I haven't seen the language, but and assuming it'll possibly go to public safety as well, but I'm glad to hear other folks are paying attention to that. With that, members, we don't have any other hands up. Vice Chair Mueller, any closing comments on your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just note for members that the underlying language of the statute that this bill is amending does make it a gross misdemeanor for anyone to use a GPS device without the owner's consent. So there is some protection for the public already. I'm not saying that that's enough, but there is some protection in the current law for the public. The problem with that protection, though, of course, for this purpose is that it makes it a gross misdemeanor then for law enforcement to use those devices unless they have owner consent. So members, ultimately, this is a matter of public safety. This is an urgent issue. I'm really glad that we're meeting this moment to provide law enforcement with the tools they need to protect the public. I appreciate your support. Thank you.
All right. With that, Vice Chair Mueller renews her motion that House File 2910 as amended be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Fang?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That is 17 ayes and no nays.
All right. With unanimous passage, House File 2910 as amended is on its way to the General Register. Thank you to our testifiers and to Vice Chair Mueller. Next on the agenda, we have House File 2671. This is a Representative Feist bill. Representative Feist, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
So Representative Feist, just to clarify, your motion would be that 2671 be referred to the General Register.
Yes, that is my motion.
Thanks. All right. The bill is now before us, and I understand you have an amendment. It looks like it's a technical amendment. Do you want to move your amendment and then tell us what it does?
Yes, I would like to move this amendment to get the bill into the shape that I'd like it.
All right. Any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the A1 amendment is adopted. Now, Representative Feist, to your bill as amended.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This bill addresses a misalignment between state and federal law that harms at-risk juveniles who have been abused, abandoned, or neglected and brought into this country for, among other reasons, sex or labor trafficking. At its core, this bill conforms our state law with existing federal law. A federal law, Special Immigrant Juvenile Status, or SIJS, was originally created under the administration of President George H.W. Bush and expanded under the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2008 to protect these vulnerable children. The law makes certain juveniles eligible if they demonstrate that they are subjected to abuse, neglect, or abandonment, and it is not in their best interest to return to their home country. A state court finding to this effect is necessary as part of the process. Under federal law, a child is defined as under 21. Under state law, however, a child is defined as under 18 for purposes of the state court order required by the federal law as part of the SIJS process. Structured to build on the successes and challenges of the 13 other states that have passed similar legislation to match their state law with federal law, this bill creates a guardianship for eligible at-risk youth through the age of 21, thereby ensuring full access to the requisite state court order for all SIJS cases. This ensures that Minnesota is compliant with federal law on the age cutoff for eligibility. Tara Farrell will share her story of becoming the guardian of Melvin Wilson, a young man from Liberia whose journey to the United States was marked by neglect and the absence of parents or any real parental figure, and who was ultimately taken in and supported by Tara and her family. The Farrells worked with attorney Rebecca Schultz to obtain SIJS for Melvin. Attorney Lindsay Greising of the Advocates for Human Rights will testify of the importance of SIJS in relation to how immigration laws protect victims of labor and sex trafficking. This bill was drafted carefully by experts in immigration and family law to incorporate lessons learned from other states that have taken this step. I am pleased to be working across the aisle with Senator Zach Duckworth to protect these uniquely vulnerable children and ensure that our system of laws protects them from being preyed upon by malicious actors by aligning state and federal law. I recently saw a bingo card, scorecard with types of state laws, and one of the boxes was types of laws that only lawyers understand and then not really. This is one of those laws. But my hope is that between me, Ms. Farrell's personal story, and the assembled experts, including Ron Elwood from Legal Aid and Rebecca Schultz, who are on hand, we can answer any and all questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. First, we'll go to the testifiers. First on the list, I have Tara Farrell. Ms. Farrell, if you can unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Tara Farrell. Sorry, first time.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Just go ahead.
Just read my statement?
Yep.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tara Farrell, and I'm here to tell the story of Melvin, who we took into our family after being abused and neglected. My story will illustrate why this bill is so important, and I ask you to please pass it. My husband and I met Melvin when he was in junior high. He wrestled with our son, Tyler. We got to know him as we traveled to different tournaments. We came to learn that Melvin was brought to this country as a small boy, and he was given to a woman called Grandma, but had no relation to him or her. She had no custody and no custody papers. We also came to learn that Melvin was abused and neglected in this home. We were very active in our children's school and in the wrestling program. At one tournament when Melvin was in 10th grade, he got injured and asked me to ride in the ambulance with him. At the hospital, Grandma would not come get him. She didn't even ask if he was okay. She said that we could take him home, but she didn't even know who we were. It was then when Melvin revealed to us the secrets of unspeakable abuse and the subject that Grandma did to him. When we learned that Melvin sometimes slept in parks and couch surfed with friends. When he was ready to leave the hospital, we took him home with us to be safe and to be part of our family. We got in touch with legal aid attorneys to see what we could do to obtain custody of him. The hearing was the day before Christmas Eve. Our parents were there, our siblings were there, our three children were there, Tanner, Tyler, and Hannah. The little courtroom was full. Everyone was emotional. Even the judge was crying. She said that in her line of work, it was not often that she got to make everyone happy. That day was the best Christmas gift I ever got. Melvin completed our missing piece of the puzzle in our family. Melvin has been in our family since. He is a good brother to all of his siblings, and he is a fine son. Melvin was very street smart, but he needed to learn life skills, how to drive, how to work hard at school, how to have a bank account, how to find a job, and how to navigate in our big family and not the streets. When Melvin was 17, we were able to go through the legal process. We made it just in time. If we had missed the cutoff, we would have been out of luck. This bill is important to us to ensure that the federal law and the state law line up so the Melvins of the world between 18 and 21 have the same chance. Without this process and the process this bill sets up, Melvin would have likely not have graduated, not have had a sister to be his best friend. He would not have had the opportunities for a successful life that he leads today. Our family taught him that love comes from hugs and kisses and food and a lot of communication and not abuse. Melvin lived with us for 2 years after we obtained custody. He was 20 years old when he moved out, but not far, only a mile away. He has two beautiful children. Melvin has given me two titles, Mom and Nana. Thank you for allowing me to tell our story.
Thank you very much. And good job on your first time testifying. I know it can be nerve-wracking, but you did a great job. So thank you for sharing your story with us today. The next testifier I have on the list is Lindsay Greising. Lindsay, if you can introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Greising, and I'm a staff attorney at the Advocates for Human Rights, which has provided pro bono legal services in Minnesota for nearly 40 years. In my role, I lead our direct client services for non-citizen victims of human trafficking. I'm here today to speak to you about why guardianship for vulnerable youth furthers the state interest in combating human trafficking and protecting victims of trafficking. First, this legislative fix better aligns our guardianship laws with the state's approach to homeless and trafficked youth, which recognizes that youth are uniquely vulnerable to trafficking through age 24. Second, providing guardianship to uniquely vulnerable youth will help prevent trafficking of minors. Traffickers use fears of deportation and lack of support as a means of coercive control to force victims, especially young people, to remain in debt bondage, sex slavery, and indentured servitude. Having guardians for vulnerable youth can significantly decrease these risk factors by providing stable housing and care, which prevent minors from looking for these things in places that may be exploitative. For example, one of our clients came to the U.S. as a minor to seek safety. However, he was not placed with a guardian. He was forced to support himself and ultimately found work with an exploitative employer who trafficked him into forced labor. He was able to escape when our office connected him with necessary supports. Finally, HF 2671 provides victims of trafficking crucial support and stability, which helps protect them from being re-trafficked and also allows them to better support law enforcement investigations and prosecutions of trafficking. One of our clients, a youth victim of sex trafficking, recently chose to return to his home country because he had no support system in the U.S. He had come to our office just after his 18th birthday, meaning he was not eligible for guardianship under current law. After explaining to me that he was homeless, had to work in exploitative jobs, and eventually felt desperate when COVID hit, he decided to return to his home country. This meant that he lost protections for victims of trafficking, and also that he is now no longer reachable as a witness for any investigation or prosecution of his trafficker. In sum, the advocate supports HF 2671 as a legislative fix that will better protect uniquely vulnerable youth from trafficking and support law enforcement investigations. It brings Minnesota's guardianship laws in line with what we have already recognized, that uniquely vulnerable youth require protections well beyond the age of 18. I will remain available for questions.
All right, thank you. I know we have a couple other attorneys available for questions as well, but no other testifiers on the list. Members, to discussion of the bill. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, and thank you for the powerful testimony by Ms. Farrell today. And Melvin is one fortunate young man to have had you in his life. And it reminds me of the movie Blindside. We were such a great story, but I do have a question for the bill's author, and I am in total support of this bill, but I'm wondering if we're going to go from age 18 to 21, will there be any fiscal cost to the state, or is this all federal dollars that are involved here as far as support services and those things?
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. We reached out to the courts to inquire into this. And we shared with them some expectations around the number of cases per year. And based on their response, we do not expect that there will be any fiscal cost to expanding the age of eligibility for this guardianship. So, Ron Elwood would like to comment any further if I explained that correctly. But I know that we did have some productive conversations because we also had this question.
Mr. Elwood, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead and add to the answer to that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Scott. Nice to see you again. We had done an estimate based on experiences in other states and the numbers that we have here in Minnesota. And we think it was a credible estimate, and it was a relatively small number. We shared that with the court administrator's office, and seems like it's a de minimis, more or less a de minimis amount and not a fiscal cost.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my question isn't so much about the courts, but let's say these youth have been receiving public services of some sort, whether that's MA or anything like that, any other services that they might be eligible to receive right now until age 18, if they're going to be eligible for those same services for three more years, is there a cost to our state budget at all? That's kind of my question. Not so much the courts, because I know there's not a lot of these cases.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is that expanding this eligibility for the guardianship would not in any way impact which public benefits these youth might be eligible for. And I can also defer to either Lindsay Greising or Rebecca Schultz if they have anything to add or can just confirm that I'm correct, because I'm answering this off the top of my head.
Sure.
All right, whichever one of you wants to take that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee and Representative Scott for your question. My name is Rebecca Schultz. Let me get my video on here. There we go. My understanding is that the guardianship itself wouldn't change anything in terms of public benefits, and that many kids that are seeking this status aren't eligible for public benefits, and they wouldn't become eligible because of the guardianship. They might, you know, potentially become eligible through a later process. But my understanding and my experience is that when youth are able to access this process, they are then able to secure employment authorization document, able to enter the workforce, able to contribute to the economy. Many of them are essential workers, like Melvin, who has a very successful construction career. And so if anything, I think that the bill would ultimately potentially assist with the economy in terms of helping these youth become independent and financially independent and otherwise, and helping them be able to contribute to the economy.
Right. Thank you. That was helpful. Follow-up, Representative Scott.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to make sure there wasn't any state cost where this bill would need to go to another committee to address those issues. So thank you for those answers. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Any further discussion to the bill? All right, Representative Feist, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. I'm really excited about this bill. As an immigration attorney, it's my mission to make sure our state and our immigration laws align properly. And this was one area that I knew was just kind of a recurring issue. And we really need to protect these uniquely vulnerable young people as intended under federal law. So I would encourage everyone to support this bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you. With that, Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 2671 as amended be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Mohler.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
And Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Chung, aye. That is 17 ayes and no nays.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 2671 as amended is referred to the General Register. And I can't believe we're this many weeks into session and I don't think I've done this yet, but I'm going to hand the virtual gavel over to Vice Chair Mohler for the next bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So members, next we'll take up Chair Becker-Finn's bill, House File 3195, related to educational data. Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to move that House File 3195 be referred to the General Register?
So moved, Madam Chair, and I do have an amendment.
All right. Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to move your amendment and explain to the committee what it does?
Yep. So I will move the A1 amendment. This amendment... we'll get into it more in depth in the full discussion of the bill, but it essentially exempts higher education institutions from the rest of what we're trying to do in the bill. The underlying idea in this bill was to protect minors from their personal data being shared, and so it didn't make sense to include our higher education institutions. And so this is an exemption so that this bill would not apply to institutions of higher ed.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, please unmute yourself. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now, Chair Becker-Finn, to your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Mohler. House File 3195 did not come from a lobbying group or anything like that. It actually came from constituents and folks on Twitter who had reached out to me about this issue. So what most people might not realize is that right now, what's considered directory information about children, about students, is considered public data. And that includes things, names, address, phone number, email, for high school athletes, even their weight, height and weight, as well as other information about students. So the default right now is that that public directory information is public. And so what this bill would do would be to make it so that instead of the default being that a child's name, home address, and contact information would be public, it would move that into being private data. The idea is that, you know, when we originally set up this public directory information in a pre-internet, pre-information age, you know, it may have been used for things like some folks might be familiar with a school giving out a directory with all the contact information for children, you know, for fellow students, things like that. And so what this would do would make it private. So you couldn't have, you know, some kind of predator or someone who's targeting children come forward. And, you know, I can say that I've been impacted by this as well, personally, in that my first year in office, some people were threatening to harm my children. And in theory, they could have called the school and said and asked for our home address. And it would be as simple as that because the default is public. And there are other cases as well where high school athletes who are minors have been targeted by for-profit institutions who are essentially taking advantage of a high school athlete who maybe is dreaming of making it to play college ball and using that public data to get their contact information, to reach out to them, to give them offers to play at an institution with no attached scholarship. And, you know, our young people who are dreaming big dreams are susceptible to that. And some of these institutions then charge ridiculous amounts for tuition after they've sort of tricked the student into thinking that they're going to play ball somewhere and live their dream. And so we're just trying to limit that that information about minors from being available to anybody who asks for it. And I know I do have one testifier. I will say the other background on this bill is that this idea has been something that's been in the works for a long time and is an example of how we can use the Data Practices Commission to further vet these types of things. We had an initial discussion about this bill many months ago. I got really good feedback from school administrators, teachers, parents, other folks. We kind of rehashed the bill to make it narrower and to really get at what we're trying to do, and that's protect people's private, you know, minors' private information from being shared publicly. So I'm really proud that we've been able to craft this in a way that I think protects kids and also doesn't make things overly difficult for our schools to do all the services and things that they do for kids. The bulk of this language was approved unanimously by the Data Practices Commission. There was a little bit of consternation about one section of it, and happy to talk about that further if folks have questions, but otherwise I will turn it over to, I do have one quick testifier, Mary Doherty, to speak to the bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. So Mary Doherty, I see that you've turned your camera on. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin with your testimony.
Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm Mary Doherty. I'm the legislative liaison for the St. Paul Public Schools, and I'm speaking on behalf of the district, the City of St. Paul, the Minnesota Library Association, and the other colleagues who met with the chair on the earlier draft, and I just want to thank her for working with us to address our concerns. House File 3195 allows students to be recognized in the yearbook at school board meetings, teams, plays, debate, rosters, but keeping the personal phone address and email private. In addition, districts like ours will be able to continue our very successful collaborations, for example, with our library system, so that students can continue to access library materials and other services. Again, I want to thank her. We really appreciate that she worked with us on the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Doherty. And I do see that there is a question, and then I believe there's another testifier. So why don't we move to the other testifier first, and then we'll get to questions. Mr. Neumeister, I think you're back to testify on this bill. I see you've unmuted, so please introduce yourself again for the record, and you can begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. 2 points to the bill. 1 point, just based on Chair Becker-Finn's comments. I just wanted to, I think, to the best of my knowledge, directory information, what is to be made public, is decided by the local school district. So if the local school district decides that email addresses, phone numbers should be available to the public, they're the ones who decide. That's what basically the outline of FERPA is. My main point of testifying today is on section one. So if you look at the new language that's added on that long list, all those are exceptions for consent. I have a major concern about the expansion of where educational data can be shared to government entities for services without the consent of either the individual, in some circumstances, an individual student can do consent, or consent of the parents. To me, this is just a broad exemption and takes away, I think, accountability to what is being shared. Educational data is not just information about young people, it's also about parents. That's what the definition is, expansive in that regards. So, Madam Chair, I do oppose section one of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Chair Becker-Finn, did you have a response to that?
I want to point out to the first point that the default in the law is that it is public, and individual school districts can institute additional protections, but many of them don't, especially if we think of our smaller school districts who may not have an entire division or staff people to sort of look into this and decide on things. The default is that it's public, and it is true that some school districts can make that change. The other point I would like to make is that parents or students can always opt in choose for themselves if they're okay with that information being shared. They can sort of opt back into sharing that data if that's what they choose. And then happy to go to the rest of the discussion with our committee.
All right, very well. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question for Ms. Doherty. Ms. Doherty, this whole language that Mr. Neumeister brought up of the new language of government entity. What government entities would the schools need to share this data with?
Representative Scott, that's a good question. Currently, and I believe you were on the Civil Law Committee when we updated the federal FERPA provision several years ago. I think when Representative Erickson was chairing the Education Policy Committee, right now, we share address information with the St. Paul Public Library for our Library Go program, and that allows our students to have, and we do provide notice to parents at the beginning of the year if they want to opt out of that opportunity, so that we can put an electronic library card on the technology with the district, and then students have access to all the library materials. And there's even online homework help in multiple language that the St. Paul Public Library offers. And it's been a really successful program. Prior to having the Library Go program, we would have students that may be at the park where the bookmobile shows up. And because they didn't have a public library some of the kids could actually bring home library books and the others could not. The other institution that we share with, because we have a relationship with Metro Transit to do transportation for our kids, some for their regular to and from, and others for our extracurricular activities. We share that information to issue the Metro Transit cards as well. So those would be two examples of how it would be used. And again, we do provide information to parents about those. Many of you probably know There's a current law that requires that we share that information to military recruiters as well. That's current law. And our parents have the option of opting out of that too.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there any other agencies that you share the data with?
Ms. Doherty.
Again, Madam Chair, I believe the other would be if the some of the higher ed institutions, if they request with the student permission records.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my concern with this section is just saying that you can share it with any government agency is really, really broad. And if the schools decided they need to share mental health data, for instance, with name an agency, they wouldn't have to come back to the legislature and get consent to do that. So my suggestion on this section would be to articulate with whom that data would be shared, which government agencies, and put a language in there that says, except for libraries or Metro Transit, whatever the schools are using right now, let's articulate those exceptions rather than putting something as broad as government entities. And also, I think it should always require in that language a consent piece. So those are my thoughts on the bill and some changes that need to be made. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Becker-Finn, any response?
Yeah, I just want to clarify for the record this section. This is not a blanket sharing of private data. The addition of government entities is in subsection J. So it would now read to volunteers or government entities who are determined to have a legitimate educational interest in the data and who who are conducting services, activities, or events sponsored by or endorsed by the educational agency or institution for students or former students. So it's not a blanket sharing to any government entity. It would have to be a legitimate educational interest, not just a legitimate interest, but a legitimate educational interest. And they'd have to be doing services and the school district would have to approve of it. So I just want for the record to just clarify that piece of it. So we're all clear about what we're talking about.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's with the language that you read off, and I appreciate it, the schools could still determine that it's in the for an educational purpose that they have to share it with their a student's mental health, for instance, with DHS or name a government entity so that child can get public services for those things. And there's no consent provision in here that they would have to get consent from the parent to offer those services to the child. So again, it's broader than one might think it is because there's no one checking with the schools to find out what their educational purpose is. There's no way of verifying that that's what's happening. So I think the language could be tightened up. I have real concerns about that section. Thank you, Madam.
All right, we'll move on to Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you, Chair Moore, Chair Becker-Finn. I wanna thank you for bringing this bill forward. I fully support the concept that, we need to keep this data private. And I want to make sure that the data is kept safe as well. I just have one question. Here at the legislature, we have a tradition of every spring, we see all our members sitting at their desk on the House floor signing graduation letters. It's a tradition that I think is very important as going through and going to graduation parties for in my district, I'm surprised just about everyone I go to, we see the letters that the legislature has sent to them. And I enjoy sending those letters and giving the congratulations to those students that have worked hard to graduate from high school and beginning the next phase of their life. I'm just wondering how would this bill would affect that? And is there a way that we can keep this stuff private, but still allow the legislature to do these graduation letters and still still protect the data and being able to continue doing these graduation letters.
Chair Becker Finn.
Thank you. And thank you for the question. So a couple things. First, some school districts already decide to not share children's home addresses. And so as Vice Chair Moeller and I are familiar with some of the school districts in our area, on our area, it's as simple as we still sign the letters, we provide them to the school, and then the school makes sure that those are passed on to students. The school can put the labels on if, you know, they can put them into packets with their graduation packets. You know, there are still ways to reach those students. I would also say that as much as politically we would love to send out those letters and reach out to our young people, I think the overall good in protecting a child's contact information outweighs any sort of gee, it's nice kind of goals that we might have as legislators. I certainly understand, you know, I get good feedback from people too when I send out those letters, and I don't think that this would necessarily stop that. It would just change the way that those letters are shared with students.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, thank you for that answer. The tough part is there's a difference between those that live in the metro with one school district. And I don't have the largest district. I have 9. It's a lot different when you have to travel 30 miles one direction to drop them off at a school, 50 miles the next direction to drop the next packet off. We also have school districts that I started doing that because I was concerned about the addresses. They refused to hand those letters out. I have to actually physically send them out. I've had to go to graduation practice and put each letter on everybody's chair. That took me over an hour and a half of my time, and some of those are during session. It doesn't work well. And then when you throw in 9 school districts with graduation practice at the same time, it doesn't work. We need to find a way, because it is important and to honor those graduates, but find a way that we can do that, that we can get those letters to them, because I believe it's important for them to congratulate them. And they really do enjoy those letters.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Chair Becker-Finn.
Yeah, I would just say that, like, I am not interested in making a special exemption for legislators in order to for us to reach out to folks for this purpose. I think the overall good in protecting private home data about children outweighs any political gains we may wish to have from those letters.
Representative Grassl.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I was trying to find my arrow on my screen for a second there. Chair Becker-Finn, I guess in listening to this conversation, the concerns of Representative Scott and some of the other concerns, all of us want to make sure that our children are protected. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I appreciate your efforts in this legislation. Would you be willing to work with Representative Scott to address the concerns that she put forward to make sure that we have this tied up to make it as secure as possible and still yet meeting that consent concern as far as where this information goes? Because if there's even a portion of leakage to where this information can get into the wrong hands. I don't want that to happen. You don't want that to happen. Chair Moeller doesn't want that to happen. Neither does Lead Scott. So, I mean, is that something that you would be willing to take a look at to help secure this even more if it can be done? And I guess, Chair Moeller, if I could ask House Research after I hear from Chair Becker-Finn.
Sure. So let's go to Chair Becker-Finn first.
Thank you for the question. Absolutely. As I think I've mentioned before, you know, as I also am an adjunct who teaches legislative process, I fully believe in our process and why we have committees. I frankly was surprised that there wasn't an amendment filed. We've discussed this issue in the Data Practices Commission. This isn't new language or a new issue, but certainly willing to work on language to tighten things up if that's what folks are more comfortable with. That's always on the table. So I'm happy to do that.
And Representative Grossel, what is your question for?
The question would be to House Research, or thank you, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. The question to House Research would be to, in hearing the concerns as far as this being secure, is there any way that they can help us to understand this better? Is this legislation susceptible to having somebody get this information that shouldn't, and should there be, you know, we want to tie that consent in there. We always want to have the parents to have consent for them to work alongside the school, or for the school to work alongside the parent to make sure that our children are protected.
Mr. Hopkins, I see you've turned your camera on. If you can answer that question, please do.
If I didn't ask the question properly, maybe Representative Scott could ask the question so to put it in the words that she wants it, to make sure that it's clear.
Well, Representative Grossel, let's give Mr. Hopkins a chance here, and then we'll see if we need clarity.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Nathan Hopkins from House Research. Yes, well, we'd be happy to work with any member of the committee to draft an amendment for the floor, if this is going to the general register, to change any language or tighten up any language for the author, or for any member, really, because it's going to the floor. So just let me know what kind of amendment you might want to request on this, and I'd be happy to work with you.
And I do see that Representative Scott's raised her hand again, so maybe we'll go over to you, Representative Scott.
Thank you, real briefly. I don't want to take away time from other people. So I guess the question for me would be to Mr. Hopkins is the language I wrote on 2.17 regarding government entity, with the addition of that language, could the schools, if they felt the need, if there was an educational purpose for sharing data with, say, a government agency that connects kids with mental health assistance, under this language, would or would not the school have to come to the legislature to get authority to do that? Or could they just share it without parental consent or the legislature's consent?
And before Mr. Hopkins answers, I'll just note too that we'll wrap this up here quickly because we do have another bill, and it does sound like the author is willing to work on potential narrowing of that language. So Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So the changes at 2.17 would allow a school district to share private educational data with a government entity, so long as without further consent from the student or the parent, so long as that government entity, one, has a legitimate educational interest in the data, and two, is conducting some kind of service or activity that's sponsored or endorsed by the school. So that could include mental health services if that's the program at issue here.
Thank you.
Oh, with that, we'll move on to Representative Herr.
Thank you. I just want to tell you thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair Becker-Finn, for bringing this forward, and thank you for your willingness to work.
Right. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Mohler, and thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, for bringing this bill forward. I did just want to state really quick that, and I don't know if maybe Mr. Hopkins, maybe this is something that we could take offline and take a look at, but I'm pretty certain that right now medical data, mental health data, cannot be shared under both HIPAA and FERPA, and that the school still has to comply with medical laws and so privacy laws. And so I just want to be very clear that that education data, mental health is not education data. That pertains to somebody's health. And so I'm not a lawyer, but I do look at policy very closely. And I would ask that maybe Mr. Hopkins and us, we can look at this offline. But I do just want to state really quick that I was initially concerned about this particular bill, and Chair Becker-Finn worked with me and our school district. And I really appreciate her willingness to always be open to suggestions and thoughts. And so I just wanted to thank you for taking in all of this into consideration. Again, I would just like to state that mental health is not education data, and that that in itself is something that we should probably look at and potentially, I don't think that this actually covers that, because we do know, I worked at the school district, and we do know that in order to share some of that information, we had to get additional parent consent for that. And so I would just like to leave my comments at that and say that thank you for bringing this bill forward, Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Representative Herr. That's an excellent point and something that they can definitely look into as this bill progresses. Chair Becker-Finn, any closing remarks?
Yeah, I just want to clarify too that this discussion about the what's online in the section J and 2.17, it doesn't change the classification of the data. The data remains private. What it does is it allows an educational institution to share that data with a government entity, but it does not allow the government entity to turn around and treat it like public data. So I know I just said the word data a lot, and that some people don't find this as fascinating as myself and Vice Chair Mueller and Representative Scott, but I did just want to clarify that this isn't like some blanket changing the entire classification. It's saying that a school is able to disclose this data for this purpose, not that it's allowing, you know, the library or Metro Transit to then do whatever they want with that data. So just wanted to clarify that. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3195, as amended, be referred to the General Register.
All right, Chair Becker-Finn has renewed her motion that House File 3195 as amended be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
And Representative Zhang.
Aye.
That is 16 ayes and one nay.
With 16 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails, and House File 3195 as amended has been referred to the General Register. And I will turn the virtual gavel back over to Chair Becker-Finn.
All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. The last bill on our agenda is House File 2458. It's a Representative Gomez bill. I will move that House File 2458 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Gomez, I knew you do have a couple test fires too, so even if we don't have time for full discussion, I do want to make sure we get to those, but I will turn it over to you, Representative Gomez, to present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for hearing this bill today. House File 2458 establishes the rights of blind parents. A lot of folks are in our communities across the state who are blind and who are raising kids. I definitely have friends who are adult children of blind parents, and you know, blind people can parent as well as anybody else. But because of fear and misconceptions about blindness, parents who are blind do experience disproportionately high rates of child removal or loss of parental rights. And so this legislation would strengthen our existing law by setting out a framework for more active prevention of discrimination in adoption, in matters of custody or parenting time, and in matters involving child protective services. And those are the three kind of sections of the bill. First deals with adoption, second with custody and parenting time, and finally the third with child protective services. So it shifts the burden of proof onto the person raising concerns to show that, you know, there are actual like specific behaviors that are endangering the health or safety of a child to sort of justify either any of those kind of three sort of categories of action. If that burden's met, you know, if there is a requirement in the bill that supportive parenting services be provided to the parents to help to kind of like address the material issues with how the child is being treated or dealt with. And if the decision is made to restrict or deny any of these rights, then the bill requires sort of an articulation about the reason for that decision to show that no discrimination has occurred and why the implementation of supportive parenting services weren't able to resolve the concerns that were raised. So this legislation doesn't require new services or funding. Similar legislation has been adopted in other states, including Maryland and Colorado. This bill is being carried by Senator Curran in the Senate. We have bipartisan authorship in both bodies, and I would ask that the committee considers it for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you, Representative Gomez. We do have a couple testifiers. First, I have Steve Jacobson. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Steve Jacobson. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As I said, my name is Steve Jacobson, and I am the Vice President of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota. We are an all-volunteer consumer advocacy organization with members all over the state of Minnesota, and we've been working in the legislative arena to improve the opportunities for blind people since 1920. I am also a parent. My wife and I are both blind, and we have raised two blind children who are now in their 20s, living on their own and employed. As Representative Gomez said, the National Federation of the Blind has documented thousands of cases of people who are successfully raising children, many right here in Minnesota. This vast experience shows that blindness is not by itself a relevant factor in whether a parent or whether a person is fit to be a parent. Even so, because blindness is not well understood, it can become a major factor in the minds of those with power to make decisions around child care. For example, blind people face higher barriers when trying to adopt children. Also, when a dispute about custody or blind or parenting time arises between blind and sighted spouses, the sighted spouse may make non-specific allegations about the incompetence of the blind spouse, which are assumed to be accurate. Further, when blind persons are confronted with dealing with visits from child protection services, there is an additional fear that the final decision may be made based on the social services worker closing his or her eyes and thinking how they would parent as a blind person without regard to the experience and the training that most blind people have. The Minnesota legislature has demonstrated its understanding that disabled parents should not be denied a role in raising their children merely on the basis of a disability. However, agencies and state courts vary in their understanding and can make generalizations. Additional procedural safeguards are needed to set a proper legal standard of proof, shifting the burden to the party raising the concern and taking into account the use of supportive parent services if such services are needed. I emphasize that this proposed legislative solution does not involve any new funding or programs. Rather, it amends Minnesota statutes to strengthen the protections related to adoption, child protection services, and legal custody and parent time. anyone making an assertion that a blind person shouldn't adopt a child or have custody or parenting time should have to first provide clear and convincing evidence of specific behaviors that threaten the health or safety of a child. If there is clear and convincing evidence, the opportunity to alleviate any concerns through the use of supportive parenting services should be made available. Supporting parent services is defined in our bill as services that may assist a blind parent in effectively using non-visual techniques to parent a child as successfully as a parent who is not blind, such as audio aids, training, or assistance of an individual or technology. They can involve mentorship from other blind parents about techniques that have worked for them, techniques such as putting bells on the shoes of a blind child to make it more easy to keep track of that child, using a talking thermometer, or using a stroller that can be pulled rather than pushed. None of these are additional governmental services. Finally, this bill would require that if a judge ultimately decides to limit or deny parental rights, the judge should have to put in writing the specific reasons for that decision, including why supportive parenting services could not have been used to resolve the situation. Not too long ago, one of our blind members was weeks away from having her first child, and she came to our president in tears after hearing some of the experiences of other parents. She was afraid, and she wanted to be sure that we would be there to help her if she had a problem like this. Some years ago, one of our colleagues was involved in a very hostile divorce case in which, despite his having stayed home to take care of his daughter for the first year of her life, and despite working professionally with children every day, he was alleged to be a safe, unsafe parent, and he was denied parental rights unsupervised. This just has to be changed, and we just have to be able to allow blind parents not to have the sort of fear that's associated with people making decisions like this while basing such decisions on closing one's eyes without relying on the experience of a blind parent. Please support this bill. Please pass HF 2458. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have another testifier, and we have permission to go a couple minutes over. So we'll go to our next testifier, Kutumu Kamara. If you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah. Hello?
Yep, please go ahead with your testimony. Okay. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Kutumu Kamara, and I moved to this country in 2003. I earned my bachelor's and master's degree at the University of Minnesota, and I currently work with English language learners who happens to be blind. I passionately and highly support HF 2458 because I don't want other blind parents to experience what I went through. On the Sunday after when I came from the hospital, when I had my daughter, I received a call the next day from a social worker saying that she wanted to come and check on me and my daughter, the baby, and I allow her to come. But at that time, I thought this were really typical thing to do in the United States because it was all new to me. She came into my home for several days and she watched me feed and change my daughter. Every time that she came, she spent a couple of time, like 30 minutes to 1 hour. She spent that time. It was very strange and uncomfortable to me, but I really thought it was normal. After the last day she came, she told me that I was doing good. And of course, yes, I was doing good because I prepared for the arrival of my daughter. I took classes and I also learned from my sister's experience, who is a mom of 6 children. So, and I did everything possible to prepare like any other mom. When she left, I was wondering that, oh, okay, so this little woman is just assuming that I couldn't take care of my kid, my child. And it was nerve-wracking for me. It was very scary. And up to this point, I feel hurt and angry that she came into my home and making me so uncomfortable. I am currently a mother of 2 daughters, very healthy and intelligent daughters, and their life is going on fine. But every time I question myself, what if I never had the skills and education to take care of my kids? Were they gonna remove my daughter because from me because of blindness? Or were they going to consider supporting parenting? So HF 2458 is going to give blind parents the right to take care of their children and also give a required coach to be able to consider other parenting supportive ways of blindness for blind people. I highly support this bill because over time I have seen the impact supportive parenting have on blindness. If blind people are given the support and mentorship, I've seen how they can be able to raise parents and be a contributing members of our society. Sighted parents always receive support. Blind people deserve the same as well to be able to raise our kids. It is touching that anybody will have your kids and then will be removed away from you. So I highly support this bill and I'm asking that it pass. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. Members, any quick discussion to the bill? And just a reminder, we're laying this over. Any discussion? Not seeing any hands. Representative Gomez, any closing comments?
I just thank you for your consideration, Madam Chair, and to the committee members. Thanks.
Right. Thank you. And with that, House File 2458 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. With that, members, it is 10:03. Good job on another busy week. And with that, we are adjourned.